Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street is on its toes looking out for new rules that Washington wants to impose. So, two questions on that topic today. Who is going to pay to keep an eye on the big banks? And is Bank of America getting ahead of the game? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us today. It is the 14th of August, and on a Friday approaching the end of summertime, the economic news looks something like this. The president is out west talking healthcare. The stock market is worried consumers still don't have any confidence. And Bank of America is trying to change its image. A change to the fine print, to be sure, but one that could wind up making a very big difference. When you get into a disagreement with your credit card company, like Bank of America, you usually head straight into mandatory arbitration. You don't have a choice. You sign away your right to sue when you sign up for the card. At least, that's the way things used to be. Bank of America has decided it's going to drop that requirement. And Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports the bank figures it'll get at least as much benefit as the customers will.
Arbitration has gotten a particularly bad name recently. The Minnesota Attorney General successfully forced two of the nation's largest arbitration firms out of the business after contending that they weren't disclosing financial ties to the companies fighting consumers in arbitration cases. Celent banking analyst Bart Narder says arbitration is becoming a PR headache for banks.
Bank of America is looking ahead and saying, this is going to generate a lot of bad publicity for us. And let's just head this one off at the pass and get ahead of any potential regulation on this.
For the record, a Bank of America spokesperson says the bank still thinks arbitration is fair. It's responding to customers who don't feel the same way. But Narder says B of A also has its eye on Washington.
Bank of America has taken one reason to create new legislation away.
And Narder says other big credit card issuers, Citibank, Chase, American Express, and Capital One, may follow the lead. That would leave consumers with the option to sue over disputes, and that makes Susan Weinstock of the Consumer Federation of America very happy.
They'll be able to go to court if that's what they choose to do, but they're not going to be bound by this arbitration that often is performed by people who have a conflict of interest, which they lose most of the time.
94% of the time, according to a recent study. The arbitration industry says one reason that number is so high is because many consumers don't bother to defend themselves in the arbitration process. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Now here's a question that reaches right to the heart of how to stop the financial crisis we are still working our way through from ever happening again. Who is going to foot the bill for stricter enforcement of Wall Street rules and regulations? Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
So the Obama administration wants to ensure much tougher regulations of all financial services firms and create an entirely new regulatory agency dedicated to protecting you, the consumer. The problem? How do you pay for it?
We are certainly willing to pay our fair share for consumer protection.
Jill Hershey's at the Financial Services Roundtable and represents the biggest banks. She's not a fan of the administration's plan to hike fees on banks that have more than $10 billion in assets. She'd like any increase in fees to hit small banks and big banks alike.
Truly, it's a cost of doing business to protect consumers, and we're all in that business together.
Not surprisingly, small banks disagree. Cam Fine is at the Independent Community Bankers Association.
Community banks didn't cause the train wreck that we're in right now, this financial crisis. So why should they be the ones to have to pay some disproportionate share to get us out of this mess?
Hershey, the big bank's lobbyist, is willing to accept some blame.
Absolutely, yes, mistakes were made. Having said that, they weren't only made or just made by larger institutions.
She says most of the banks that have failed in the past year have been smaller. But finger-pointing aside, there's one thing bankers generally agree on. They hate the idea of a new agency dedicated solely to protecting consumers, and they're working together on Capitol Hill to kill that piece of President Obama's banking overhaul. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
From finance to flying now, Boeing executives have been losing sleep over their new plane, the Dreamliner, for a while. It's years behind schedule. And the Chicago-based company confirmed today that it has found a new problem that has stalled production, this one with the plane's outer shell. High-tech composites are proving to be a good deal trickier than good old-fashioned aluminum. Joel Rose reports.
Boeing has plenty of experience working with composite materials, basically super-hard reinforced plastics. They're already used in the F-22 fighter jet and the B-2 bomber. Still, the 787 Dreamliner is a big leap forward.
The requirements for an aircraft like the F-22 or the B-2 are very different from the requirements for a plane that flies from Boston to China.
John Ostrower is the editor of Flight Blogger, which first reported the work stoppage at the Italian plant. He says composite is lighter and more durable than aluminum, but it can also be harder to work with.
The way airplanes have always been built before is that you've had paneled aluminum around a circular fuselage. Now what you have is single-piece barrels of composite material, with the structure literally cooked into it,
making it that much harder to fix individual sections of the plane's fuselage. But Boeing officials are trying to downplay the work stoppage. Spokesperson Lori Gunter says the company has already developed a patch, which it's applying to the sections of fuselage where the flaws were discovered.
You find these things in the beginning, you work the solutions, and you move forward.
Gunter insists the setback won't affect the timing of flight tests or the delivery of the plane, which is already 2 years behind schedule. When it arrives, Boeing says the Dreamliner will open up long-distance routes that aren't profitable with the current fleet of jets. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Traders tried to pull off a U-shaped recovery today, down at the open, flat during the day, rising at the close. Didn't quite get there, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Moving can be a nightmare. The packing and unpacking, the changing of addresses, all of it just adds up to one big fat bad experience. So nobody does it unless they have to. Throw in falling house prices and a still weak job market, and more people are simply staying put. That means moving companies have fewer customers nowadays. But it is not just the recession that's causing headaches for traditional movers. Lenora Chu reports.
When Jerry Eldred had to relocate from New Hampshire to Texas, his new employer gave him a shoestring budget for the move.
I definitely could not do one of the Cadillac moves, Mayflower and those sorts of companies.
The quotes he got from full-service movers came in at $7,000 and up. So he hopped on uship.com. That's the online site where movers bid for your business. Eldred listed the contents of his three-bedroom house and stated his price.
So I put my low-ball figure in there. The lowest I thought somebody might possibly be willing to take.
The bids started coming in. Eldred read the online reviews of companies who submitted quotes and eventually chose a local trucker. Eldred said he was nervous at first about trusting his belongings to someone he found on the internet, but he met with a trucker first before signing on the dotted line. The final price? A touch over $3,000, and his stuff arrived safe and sound.
So for a lot less money, I got a lot faster delivery. That was kind of the amazing thing to me.
And it's been amazing for uship.com. The company's revenues have doubled over the last year. That's despite census data that shows fewer Americans moved in 2008 than at any time since 1962. Uship CEO Matt Chasen.
So I think people are kind of just changing their behavior and going to places like Uship where they can try to get better pricing and more competitive quotes.
Enter the new landscape for the moving industry, where buyers and sellers connect on the internet. Steve Weidekamp is president of the California Moving and Storage Association.
10 years ago, the average consumer went to the Yellow Pages, opened up the section that said movers, and the traditional movers had the large ads. Now, most people go onto the internet, they type in movers, and they get all kinds of options.
Traditional movers are having to get creative to find new customers and inspire loyalty, especially when plummeting house prices mean people are staying put. In Santa Monica, Anne Berkeley is watching movers roll a barbecue grill into her new home. Her mover, Ram Catalan, is supervising a half dozen workers on the job. He says his full-service company, North Star Moving, has seen year-over-year growth screech to a halt.
These days worth about the 12 to 14% decrease from previous year.
So Catalan is going the extra mile on branding and service. He's greening up his moving trucks with biodiesel, slashing prices when customers ask for recycled boxes, and putting pets in a luxury daycare free of charge during a move.
We understand that being a moving company is not just about moving boxes from one place to another. It's about making sure that we address all of our clients' needs.
Catalan's not worried about the online competition, he says, because he has loyal customers like Berkeley. Berkeley has hired North Star before, and she says she'd do it again.
Putting everything you own in the hands of some company that you don't really know is sort of, for me, uncomfortable.
Berkeley says moving is too personal to trust to the internet. In Los Angeles, I'm Lenora Chu for Marketplace.
Most of this week's news was of health care reform, the politics of it, not the economics so much. But that's okay because the economy provided its own entertainment. Inflation has essentially disappeared, we learned this morning. The summer rally on Wall Street has done something similar. And the Federal Reserve did nothing at all, which was all kinds of news. Here to help us do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond are business writer Heidi Moore and John Carney. He writes for ClusterStock.com. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Glad to be here.
All right. Had the Federal Reserve this week. Heidi, we're going to start with you. The key phrase that came out of that was leveling out. So Ben Bernanke says everything's fine, yes?
I'm sure it's fine for Ben Bernanke. The rest of the economy may has yet to get that memo. What the Fed did this time around by not raising interest rates and keeping them at rounding up to the nearest zero, as it were, is interesting because the Fed has a lot of really big fights on its hands right now in terms of its future and what it's going to look like and whether it's going to be a super regulator. And so I think in the politics of it, you're now getting to see the Fed as a political animal rather than just a pure mechanical way to set monetary policy. So you could read that very easily as they just wanted to pick their battles. They didn't want to get into the interest rate battle because they have the fight for their jobs coming up in just a few months.
Interesting thought. John, you buy that?
I do buy it. I think there's actually a real danger because the Fed is eventually going to have to raise interest rates to fight off inflation. And they're going to have to do it while unemployment is still going up. And at the same time, you have Ben Bernanke worrying about whether he gets to keep his job. And the thing is, we've really never seen anything like this before, where you have this immense political pressure and then this economic pressure. There will be a need to do some very probably steep rate hikes in order to fight off all of the money that's been poured into the system, creating a massive hyperinflation.
Well, so Heidi, when is that point going to come? Because there will eventually be a day, right?
It will come when Bernanke does let go of this idea that he should be a political figure. It can be very seductive. You know, you have all this press coverage, all of a sudden you're a rock star. But what it does is that it tends to exert a kind of subtle pressure to basically please the most powerful interests. And in this case, those are the banks. low interest rates really benefit the banks because the banks aren't lending. So they get to just basically use those low interest rates for their own benefit without actually passing it on to the consumer.
John, this is a remarkably cynical conversation. I mean, if you really step back and think about it.
Right. We used to all wonder sort of what the Fed was going to do from time to time. And there was this great guessing game. But now we all actually feel like we understand what's really going on in their minds. And it's not very pretty. I almost wish we could go back to the days when we didn't know, when we just guessed by the color of Alan Greenspan's tie what the interest rates were going to do.
John, let me try to get at something here that we talked about a little bit earlier this week on the program. The day that Bernanke decides he does have to raise interest rates, what happens in the market the day that news hits? And I mean the broad market.
I think that it will actually be a positive for the market. There's a big worry right now about whether the Fed will be able to successfully prevent inflation from getting out of control. That holds down stocks, that holds down bonds. So the day the Fed actually comes in and says, you know what, we're going to raise interest rates, people will, one, take that as a signal that the Fed thinks the economy has improved enough. Two, they'll actually be satisfied that the Fed is doing something about inflation. I think it'll be a net positive.
Heidi, the day they take the punch bowl away, what do you think?
I think the whole question of inflation actually is a bit of a distraction from some of the deeper problems that are going on in the economy. I mean, sort of the mortgages that are weighing down the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, the debt that's still strapping down the U.S. consumer. And I think that part of what's going on here is that we're not dealing with our current reality because we're so anxious to be able to predict what happens next month or the month after. Well, what that means is we're not cleaning up our house.
So you think these rates are going to stay low for a while then?
Yeah.
Spitball it for me here, John. How long do you think it's going to be before Bernanke decides to raise rates?
I don't think he'll do it in 2009. I think we will wait till 2010, right after Bernanke gets his job secured, we will see rates start to go back up.
And again, we're back to the cynicism. You guys kill me. Unbelievable. Heidi Moore and John Carney, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks.
Coming up, why anniversaries make us so happy.
The way media is working now with 24-hour news cycles where you have to have something on all the time, they would do a big deal anniversary every year if they could, every day of the year.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 0.8% today, 76 points, 9,321 the number. The NASDAQ fell 0.1%, 23 points, finished at 1,985. The S&P 500 slid 0.8%, 8 points, ended at 1,004. For the week, the Dow fell 0.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 0.7%. The S&P 500 lost 0.6%. Republic Airways took off 10% today on news Southwest Airlines pulled out of a bidding war over Frontier Airlines. Southwest descended 1.7%. Boeing dumped down 3.75% on that news we told you about its production problems. Investors looking for a safe haven piled into bonds today. That pushed prices higher. The yield on 10-year T-notes dropped to 3.5%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday, August 17th. President Obama's Western road trip continues with a speech to veterans in Arizona. The National Association of Home Builders releases their monthly look at the housing market. And yes, we are talking to you, Robert De Niro. The Oscar award-winning actor turns 66 on Monday. I'm Jolie Myers.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is a movie opening today that, to be honest, I'm not sure I'm going to go see. Looks a little scary, and as I think I've said, I don't really do scary movies. The advertising campaign for District 9, though, that's the movie in question, that is something to see.
It's going to be quick. It's going to be clean. Best of all, it's going to be quiet.
Sony, the studio behind District 9, hired a Hollywood marketing firm called Trigger. They're using something called augmented reality to get people pumped up about this movie. What is augmented reality, you ask? Yeah, I didn't know either. So I called up entertainment journalist Claude Berdesser-Ackner, and we went to find out. Claude, we are obviously not in the friendly confines of the Frank Stanton Studios.
No, we are not.
Where are we?
We're at Trigger, of course, in West Los Angeles, which is a youth marketing company, as if anybody wants to market to anybody else.
Trigger's offices are filled with toys and gadgets and free food and drinks. There's a handful of young people working quietly at their computers. Trigger producer Evan Fisk explains the nuts and bolts of what brought us here.
Augmented reality is basically a way of overlaying images, information, on a video screen or a display or a monitor. So as far as someone sitting in front of a PC, they could hold up a card in front of their webcam.
All right, so let's decipher that. Evan is holding up a postcard that has the District 9 logo on it. You might have seen it on billboards, the outline of a scary beetle-like creature. Evan puts the card in front of the camera that's attached to his computer. Out of nowhere, the scary beetle thing shows up on the computer screen, and bingo, you're controlling it in an augmented reality game.
Welcome to Multinational United's online training
simulation. I can actually click buttons, I can make him fire a gun, jump up and down, and attack a perfectly harmless human and throw him up against the wall.
Equipment needed for this is a webcam and a computer, basically.
Yeah, webcam, a computer, and if you don't have a card, you need a printer to print out the image, but that's about all you need.
And just a few million dollars in Sony marketing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, speaking of the Sony marketing budget, we have a Sony digital marketing guy here. Joe Epstein runs Sony's digital marketing group.
More and more we're experimenting with it because what it does, it turns every poster, every billboard, every icon on the side of a popcorn bag into a potential digital engagement opportunity.
That's corporate speak, of course, for marketing to us at all times on all of our digital toys. Claude Brodesser-Ackner points out that because most cell phones have webcams nowadays, companies can use this augmented reality to help sell to us wherever we are. Say, walking past a poster for District 9 with that scary beetle thing on it. You hold your cell phone up, the web browser in your phone recognizes the image, and off you go into a game. You're being marketed to, and you're enjoying it. And as Claude says, the technology is only going to get better.
The GPS function within the augmented reality game is going to unlock, if you will, a level of the game that you can only play when you're at McDonald's. And when you succeed in that level, you then get a coupon for a dollar off a Big Mac.
There's all kinds of business to be done with augmented reality. The Postal Service has an application. You hold something you want to ship up to a webcam. It shows you on your computer screen your package inside the right size box. Trigger's Evan Fisk says pharmaceutical companies have been calling, and others.
We're talking with some nonprofits who want to make it help users connect to see where their money's going. So if you're donating to someone to help women in need in some poor third world country, you can see in a virtual way how your money is going to help them. You can see the new bicycle they're going to be able to buy with the money they make from this, or the new job they're going to get.
Still, is augmented reality going to get me into the theater for District 9 this weekend? I don't think so. This weekend is the 40th anniversary of Woodstock. You can celebrate by buying a 40th anniversary Woodstock box set, or seeing the 40th anniversary Heroes of Woodstock reunion concert. Or you can check into San Diego's Hard Rock Hotel and get yourself a free 40th anniversary pot brownie. It's served in a pot, not actually made of pot. Anniversaries only go so far, after all. But what is it with 40th anniversaries anyway? Marketplace's Rico Galliano had a look-see.
Here's a quiz. A 25th anniversary is silver, 50th is gold. What's 40th? It's ruby. And you didn't know that because no one used to make a big deal about 40th anniversaries, but marketers are changing that.
Walt Disney presents the 40th anniversary special edition of The Jungle Book.
Now Snap-on is making history with Mustang 40th Anniversary Special Edition Tool Storage.
And don't forget last month's 40th anniversary of the moon landing, around which Omega aired an endless series of wristwatch ads starring JFK.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
So why make 40th anniversaries the new 50th? Nancy Kane is a business historian at Harvard. She says to understand that, first, you need to understand this.
Marketers love anniversaries because it's a way of associating their product with something appealing and engaging.
Namely, a celebration. And she says in hard times like these, marketers are looking for any celebration they can find. It also doesn't hurt that right now, 40th anniversaries commemorate events from the late 60s. And you know who that appeals to?
Baby boomers. And so to declare the 40th anniversary, the Ruby moment, suddenly important, and then try and link it to different products is quite powerful.
But some say the boomer connection is simply a happy accident, and that as far as marketers are concerned,
just any anniversary is important now.
That's Jason Torchinsky. He's co-editor of Ad Nauseam, a book of essays on consumer culture. He says the 40th anniversary phenomenon is just the latest step in marketers' holidayification of everything.
Basically, any calendar day of the year that you pick, there's some day that commemorates it. You know, there's National Denim Day, you know, National Ice Cream Month, something that somebody can go out to use to sell an ad to someone. And I think this is just part of the same plan.
And Torchinsky says that marketing plan is aided and abetted by me, as in the news media, because an anniversary provides an easy excuse to fill airtime with anniversary stories.
The way media is working now with 24-hour news cycles where you have to have something on all the time, they would do a big deal anniversary every year if they could, every day of the year.
Which might explain why cable TV became Moonshot Central last month. But wait, at half an hour, Marketplace has no problem filling airtime, and we ran a piece about the moonwalk too. Something else is at work here. So I spoke with Brett Israel. He edited the Woodstock coverage in last weekend's edition of the Los Angeles Times, and he says he actually dislikes anniversary stories as a rule.
News is what happened today or what's going to happen tomorrow. And I wasn't even thinking about Woodstock very much until I saw an early screening of Ang Lee's new movie Taking Woodstock, which I quite liked, and really does capture the cultural and emotional fascination of the festival in a fresh way.
Which made Israel think maybe the LA Times could also find a fresh way to look at Woodstock. Which makes me wonder if marketers hoped that would happen when they set the movie's release date to coincide with Woodstock's 40th anniversary. Around and around. Does marketing drive media, or does media drive marketing? Man, this is blowing my mind. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace. Peace.
As long as we're being nostalgic, here's another one, courtesy of some of the staff here at Marketplace. With college about to begin, we decided to fess up and come clean about our money mishaps back in the day. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says College Confessions. Have a look at the picture, see if you can guess who's behind which of the stories. Here's a couple of hints. Rico's hair was a lot shorter back then, and I was a lot heavier.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, call it the power of a good brand or maybe all the wine that is fit to drink. We know newspapers are doing anything they can to scratch out new revenue. And so the New York Times this week gave us the New York Times Wine Club. The paper's editors and reporters won't actually be picking the vintages for you. The Times has licensed its brand to a firm that operates these kinds of clubs for groups with higher-end demographics. Me, I was kind of hoping they'd come out with something like a Sulzberger Chardonnay after the family that owns the paper, but nobody asked me. I don't know. That is Marketplace this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 76 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq down 23 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, when do you need help to get out of debt? Probably sooner than you think.
You are starting down the path of trouble the minute you don't pay your credit cards in full every month.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will be back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.